shares, market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that bends it like Buffett. I'm Andrew Page. With me is Scott Phillips.
Good, Andrew. Good. I feel like I kind of get that, I think.
Mate, it's not easy. Every week you've got to come up with something new.
You do, don't you? You're doing a good job.
Well, let's move on. Today on the podcast, earnings roundup. We
yes.
are right in the thick of it, and results are flying thick and fast. Some good, some not so good. So we'll try and talk about some of the more noteworthy companies.
Nice.
And we have to talk about poor old McGrath, from the penthouse to the basement, the company and the man behind the company in a little bit of strife.
Oh, real estate penthouse.
You like it?
Yeah, yeah, I do. That's good.
Bitcoin. Again, with Bitcoin. But it's back up above $10,000.
Everything
so
is good.
We have to talk about that.
We do.
And it's your turn, I think, my friend, to get on your high horse.
Oh, get ready. I'm not sure what I'm going to rate about this time.
Well, we'll make it up as we go. Just to do something different.
There was a lot of rants in my head. I just have to find one and draw it out.
You are not short of a rant. You've just got...
Oh, says you. Just come on. I would let that go from almost anybody else except for you. The man who has perennially got his fist raised and shouting at clouds.
Kettle to pot. mate, let's talk about earnings season. So Australian companies typically report twice per year.
Mm-hmm.
We've got most companies, their first half of their financial year ends on December 31, and we're starting to see some results. They all have to report by the end of February. And let's go through some of the bigger profile ones. I think we have to talk about Telstra, the mum and dad
heard
stock.
Of it.
Everyone virtually owns it. And I say everyone because even if you don't have a share trading account or anything, you've got Super, and your Super account will have Telstra
Trust
shares.
Trust us, you own Telstra.
You've got Telstra shares.
I think it's the most widely owned stock among retail investors too, I have to say.
It is, and that is a consequence of the floats. They had T1 back in the day, T2.
The T3 that pretty much wasn't went to the future fund, and the government said, oh, there it goes.
It always makes me think of the Terminator movies, but that's something
just you.
Else entirely.
If we had a T1000, mate, we're in a world of hurt.
We are really in a world of hurt. So good old Telstra. This is a company that has... let's say it's been struggling in recent times.
It's fair to say.
It is a very, very large company, as we all know. And being a large company in a mature market, it's always tough to grow. Add on top of that the fact that there is a very substantial structural change underway,
right,
in the sense that they're losing their wholesale network monopoly. We're moving to the NBN.
Never heard of it. Has it been in the news at all recently?
Just a little bit. And that is creating for them a very well-publicized, what they call an earnings hole. There's $3 billion in money that they used to make that they will no longer make in a post-NBN world.
Earnings holes are really good things, I think.
Why is that?
Well, because there's a hole and it's an earnings hole and they're not there and it's bad, right?
Wait, so how's that a good thing?
I said it's a bad thing.
Oh, yes. Right. Yes, it's a bad thing. It's definitely a bad thing.
All right.
If you're a Telstra shareholder, as we all are.
And yet,
they didn't deliver too bad a result.
They did cut their dividend to 11 cents for the half.
Yeah, that was well flagged.
Indeed.
Now, it didn't go down well when it was first flagged, but it wasn't a surprise this time around.
If you've got bad news, get it out early, I always say.
We talked about it at the time. I think it is a very sensible move. Their dividend just was not sustainable. It is far more aligned with their cash flows and in terms of their capital expenditure, which is a fancy way of saying how they're going to spend money in the future, and they should be, because of this earnings hole. You have to make that up. And Telstra's got two plans here. The first is to be a little bit more productive, to be a little bit more efficient. So we're going to cut some costs, we're going to run a tighter ship, and we're going to extract some savings. And in fact, when they reported, they've made some good progress on that front.
Okay, you said two plans. Tell me plan B isn't robbing a bank.
Plan B is... invest like crazy in the foundations for future growth.
Right, I see.
They've said that they're going, again, we're going to, it's another $3 billion figure, but they've said, look, we want to try and spend around $3 billion in the coming years. They've spent about half of that now. And the lion's share of that has gone into new networks. Mm. And most notably, 5G. 5G is coming, people. And it promises far better speeds. And
all the Gs.
All of the Gs. And it should... fingers crossed, hopefully, provide a bit of an earnings boost and help them plug that hole. So Look, all said, all told, this is...
All finished.
Given these challenges...
No more bets.
Given these challenges, you've got a business that is going to really struggle to grow. Even if these investments start to pay off, it's still, you know, you're just offsetting losses that will be made elsewhere. But then you look at it, as I have, and you think, well, given that 22 cent annualized dividend and given the franking credits... I'm actually getting more than 9% just on the income alone. So in other words, if I don't get any earnings growth and I'm just going to get my dividend each and every year, it's kind of like a bond we talked about last week.
Except it's about 4.5 times the rate you get in a bank, right? So that's pretty good.
It's pretty good. So for me, Telstra is nothing, you know, it's not a sexy stock. It's not going to grow. Don't buy it if you're expecting some nice, easy capital gains, which, by the way, if you ever know of any nice, easy capital gains, let me know.
It's give us a call.
No such thing. But it is going to deliver, I think, if you are an income investor, particularly at these prices. What say you?
I think you're pretty much right. I recommended our members, Share Advisor, buy this long time ago, and I've thus far been wrong, outright wrong.
Yeah, I'll put my hand up for that too.
The challenges were real. What I had hoped was that Telstra would be able to plug that earnings hole that you mentioned more quickly and more fully than they have been able to, and that still remains the risk. So if there's a downside risk here, it's that even if with that 9% yield, even assuming it's sustainable, if earnings fall away further and you have a 10 or 20% capital loss, that's like a couple of years plus worth of dividends just to be made whole again. So there's always, you've got to always be a little bit careful with yield. You need to assess the capital gain potential and the total return in that conversation. But that's, yeah, to your point, that's the both the cost and the benefit, the opportunity and the risk of Telstra. I think it's attractive at the current level. I really, really, really like its mobile business. My hope was that mobile would grow faster and that the fixed line decline would be slower or at least be basically subsumed by that mobile growth. That hasn't been the case, hence the earnings hole. Probably should have seen it coming maybe in hindsight. I probably had too much optimism around that turnaround. But that said, from the current price and given the rate of growth and the success of customer attraction for Telstra, they're still getting members or customers on their mobile business hand over fist. They have the biggest, the best, the fastest network in the country. I don't expect they'll give up that lead. As long as they don't, Telstra should be a good investment for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I agree with that. Mate, talk to me about Maya. We've touched on Maya before.
Yes, we have.
But there's been a new development.
It's one of those stories that kind of keeps on giving, right? Which is either great if you love the idea, and if you're sick of hearing about it, then we apologize in advance. Myer's been a real absolute car crash of a company, of a stock, of everything, a strategy, a PR, you know, disaster, the whole kit and caboodle. Myer has been facing massive, massive challenges. They are kind of three or fourfold. The first is that it was once upon a time the everything store. Now, that's coincidentally or not coincidentally the name of the Amazon book being written more recently. Amazon now has the biggest and best depth and width of products in the world. Secondly, it was the place you went as a destination. That is now Westfield, the shopping centre, rather than Myer. The shopping mall has replaced the department store as the destination shop. And thirdly, there are a whole lot of specialty stores that have opened up that do what Myer does, but better. And again, combining that with the idea of the mall, the Westfield idea, the shopping centre. If you want fashion, there's a half a dozen fashion stores in a Westfield. If you want white goods, there's a half a dozen of those, three or four of those. If you want TVs, if you want computers, if you want books, there is everywhere else in almost every shopping mall in the country that also has a Myer or a DJ's where you can get the same stuff, probably cheaper, probably better service, probably more advice. Myer is struggling for relevance, and a retail business struggling for relevance is really going to struggle to get customers through the door. That's the Myer story writ large, and it doesn't at this stage have any sense of being able to turn it around.
Okay, so we've talked about that
a lot.
I don't think either of us are optimists when it comes to Myer.
I'm on the record as being massively pessimistic.
But there was a new development, though.
Yeah, well, see, this is... I do wonder what the... So we've talked about Solly Lew rattling the Myer board cage, right? Yeah. And that's happening.
He thinks they're doing a pretty bad job.
Right. So the board basically made the current or the now past CEO, Richard Umbers, walk the plank on the back of bad results.
And did in the same breath... Did he get a golden parachute? I think I feel obliged to ask that just because that's...
I actually
that's
don't. I haven't bothered, but I'm sure he probably did.
He's not hurting.
So on one hand, they say, right, Umbers, your fault. You're out. Gone.
Okay.
In the same breath, or
you
maybe half
guide,
a breath later.
Don't you? Yeah.
Well, this is the problem. They then say, but we're still committed to the strategy. And it's kind of like this. Myer's issue is not an execution issue. It's a strategic issue.
Yeah.
If they can't find a way to change what they... So it's, you know, the ship is sinking. We're going to fire the captain. The first mate's now the captain. And by the way, the ship is still sinking.
We're going to keep doing what we were just doing previously under
the exactly what it is. And so I for the board is so invested in this new Myer, the so-called new Myer strategy now. I guess they feel like they have no other choice. But if you're going to go so far as to dump your CEO because the results are terrible, you've got to admit the strategy is wrong. You've got to do something differently. Otherwise, the share price will remain in free fall. It's a straight out, you know, I don't know for the life of me why they haven't realized this is not working, done something differently. I imagine the shareholder pressure. I imagine they frankly feel like they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Myer's only solution, only saving grace to my mind, is to shrink its store footprint by about half. And that means closing a whole lot of stores. That means shrinking the stores they have, trying to basically become a more concentrated, more highly efficient return per square foot space, probably fewer overall staff, maybe more per segment that they keep. It requires radical surgery. And I get that from a corporate perspective, if you're a board director, the last thing you want in your reputation is I killed my eye trying to save it. But honestly, if this was a private business, the PE guys would be saying, we're closing half the stores, we're shrinking the rest, we're going to get down to the products we either do better or cheaper or more completely than somebody else. We have to redesign our reason for being. The board has not got that strategy. It is not happening. And short of some stroke of luck, they're not going to be able to fix the Myer business. And they're still just simply not doing anything about it. It boggles the mind.
I agree. Let's talk about Insurance Australia Group,
yes.
IAG.
Never heard of them.
This is the country's largest insurer. It was also a very commonly held stock amongst retail investors.
And why was
that? It was spun off of, or demutualized, I think the term is, from NRMA.
Correct.
So a lot of people got shares just for being members. They should have gotten shares. They were part owners in it. And so what has happened there? Well, they had some results. They were really good, 24% up in profit. Hurrah. What I wanted to mention, though, so that's great result.
Before you do mention anything else, I want to talk about that a little bit, just in a small amount of detail.
Sure.
We'll talk about it with Suncorp in a minute, and it's appropriate there too, because insurers, as a matter of course, have very, very volatile earnings. The amount of an exposure to natural disasters is the big swing factor every single year in an insurer's profit.
And you can't predict it,
right?
You know it's going to happen on average, but if it's this year, next year...
Correct. And so that's why I would just say that 24% growth is attractive and fantastic and wonderful. It's also, though, pure luck, circumstance, happenstance, call it what you will. They simply didn't have a lot of payouts to make on natural disasters. It will be different next year. And if profit's down 20% next year, it equally won't be a disaster, just as this year isn't a stonking success, unbridled and somehow fantastic. They're not going to get this sort of growth every year. They simply can't. They rely on nature, and this year nature was nice.
You have to normalize, to use the parlance, the horrible parlance.
Well, this is where it makes some sense, right? Normalizing actually does make sense in this context, because you do want to see the average return, like a casino business. You want to normalize that and say, let's assume the average result is X. Based on known cyclicality, what does that look like?
Yeah, it's just applying some common sense and some basic mathematics to it. So they had a good result, you know, with the important caveat that you mentioned. Why I thought it was interesting is because we are fans of a certain Omaha-based octogenarian, Mr. Buffet.
Indeed.
Uncle Warren, as we like to call him. And back in 2015, he took a bit of a nibble.
He did.
At IAG. In fact, he bought about almost 4%, in fact, of the company.
Dude, I'm gonna do a bit of inside baseball here.
Okay.
I have to.
Go on.
Now, listeners can't see this, but I'm looking at our run sheet as we talk, and you have fair dinkum spelt buffet as buffet, not Buffett. Now, for those who don't know, that is a sackable offence at the Motley Fool, and I am horrified, as always. So I'm not going to let you get away. Even though no one in listener land had to know, I feel duty-bound to call it out. I'm changing it on our shared document as we speak because it offends me so much.
I appreciate you pointing that out. And let me just say that was a test, and you passed. So well done.
But tell me,
I can still be friends with you now that you picked that very deliberate intentionally did.
The coffee's on you. Tell me about what Warren Buffett did with that.
For starters, if I haven't learned this lesson already, it's a miracle. But I don't seem to have. When he did that, I should have said, maybe I'll buy some as well, because it turns out shares are up about 35% since he did that. He is a very smart capital allocator. He also has this very interesting, what they call a quota agreement, which basically means that...
This is going to make good radio, I can tell already.
Berkshire Hathaway, I don't know, I'm committed to it, I'm going to go ahead. Berkshire Hathaway gets 20% of the gross written premiums, of the insurance company, and they pay out 20% of the claims. Now, why is that good? Well, for IAG, it basically means much smoother sailing. It helps knock the edges off things a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. So, look, I think it was a very good move. It was a very good result. Buffett's done very well, and I just thought it deserved a bit of a mention.
I'm going to take slight disagreement with your perspective there. And I'm going to do it because I think there's one thing that some people... Look, IG has done exceptionally well since the buy. I agree with you. The thing was, though, don't forget, Buffett got the shares at a very, very good price as part of this quota deal. Yeah. And so to some degree, like all things Buffett does, some things you can mirror for yourself. Other times he's getting a better deal than the rest
of us. You're saying I just can't ring up IAG and get a cracking deal?
I wouldn't stop you asking, mate. I don't like your chances, though.
Yeah.
And so, I think that's the, for my mind, so he got a good deal. He's also doing this quota sharing thing. And I've got to say, I'm really fascinated by the deal.
Yeah.
Because IAG is basically renting out its brand.
Yeah.
So in the past, IAG was an insurance company. Its job was to take on risk, yeah. right? And yes, it had brands, but it was largely trying to work out, how much do I charge for the insurance? How much am I going to have to pay out? What's left?
Yep.
That was what an insurer does.
Yep.
IAG has changed its model now. It's about a third. So Buffett plus some other reinsurers in Europe have now owned about a third of the gross written premiums yep. and the risk associated with that. Now, that leaves the question, what does IAG actually do then? What is it as a business? Right. And to some degree, it becomes an insurance brand.
Yeah.
It's almost a white labeled insurer now, where it says I'm a retailer of insurance under the RMA brand and others.
Yeah.
But I'm not carrying a third of that risk. Someone else is doing it.
A bunch of reinsurers out there.
Right. Yeah. And so on one level I'm kind of like, well, what are you if not an insurer?
Mm.
On the other hand, I think, well, if you can charge a brand premium and basically just quarantine that brand premium, you get a retail benefit for the brand that you use. Someone else carries the risk and the profit, we should say.
Yep.
But you kind of you do remove that volatility, to your point. Now, a good insurer should want that volatility because they'll make a fortune doing it.
Yes.
A bad insurer should never want the volatility because it's too risky for their business.
They won't survive it.
Mm. IAG generally has been a pretty good insurer, and I think, you know, to the extent that I fall somewhere in between here. At some point, if NRMA stops being an insurer and just becomes a brand, and you no longer can trust that. I don't know what that does to their business. On the other hand, if they do it really, really well and are able to charge a nice premium with no capital at risk because they've outsourced the capital to somebody else, if you get an insurance margin, a retail margin effectively for that business, well, good on you and good luck to you.
Doesn't seem bad, does it?
Exactly.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
We better move on. Let's talk a bit about poor old McGrath.
Dear, oh dear.
So McGrath is...
So from Meyer to Buffett to McGrath, we've done the waterfront, haven't we?
We have. So poor old McGrath. Many people will know him from, is it Dragon's Den?
Probably. I think he was on, wasn't he on one of those renovation shows once?
Oh, yeah.
I think he was on that Scotty Cam one. What's that called? People are yelling at the radio right now. The Block. He was on The Block.
I don't watch the rubbish, so I wouldn't
Come on.
It's terrible
TV.
Our friends at
Channel 9 do a wonderful job with The Block.
I'm the record for saying it's terrible TV. Anyway.
That's Andrew Page, P-A-G-E. I'm still open to Channel 9 for any appearances or paid work you want to offer me.
I'd like to say I have
happily
a
push my
brow,
friend off the building if I need to.
Like watch list, but I don't know if cartoons and Japanese manga sort of count. So let's...
Plus computer games.
The boy who never grew up. So let's...
Andrew Peter Pan Page. That could stick.
Let's do a recap here. So it's a real estate agent, and they listed on the stock market not that long ago for $1.90 a share.
Not just a real estate agent, a Sydney real estate agent.
Sydney real estate agent. And
your favourite people, as I
love real estate agents. Gosh, they add value. They add so much value. I wish I could enter details into realestate.com and open doors and, drive Maseratis.
There you go, a portion of our listenership. My apologies. Again, that's Page, P-A-G-E.
I'm not angry at all.
Send him your hate mail.
And so anyway, it's gone from $1.90 a share down to 40 cents a share. And, which I'm devastated about, of course.
That is rivaling Meyer for falls, I've got to say.
It is hot. Explain to me, where is the competitive advantage in this? The only asset that a real estate agent has is a bit of brand and its people.
Yeah.
And they have been bleeding people, all their best agents. And I know I was a little bit harsh before, but there's a lot of good agents out there, and the good ones have all left. They're, screw this for a game of soldiers. There's nothing in this for us. They have gone, and the business is in all kinds of trouble.
Right.
$25 million first half loss. They wrote down the value of their sales division by $22 million. On top of that, poor old McGrath has got a $16 million gambling.
This is John McGrath the person.
A $16 million gambling.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
We should say, I don't think it's been confirmed, so I'll say allegedly.
Didn't he confirm? Didn't he come out and say, it's got nothing to do with my shares?
He said he has a credit account with a bookmaker. He didn't confirm the amount of money, so we shouldn't be a little bit careful, a little bit mindful.
Sure. Some might say where there's smoke, there's fire. But some might say that.
Next week, we'll have a different co-host.
We've got the cash balance dwindling. What a disaster, mate. And you know what? This is my point.
You have money set aside for bail, haven't you?
This is my point to you.
Yeah.
You're not a good lawyer, but I need to. Anyway.
Please don't insult the lawyers. The real estate agents aren't going to help you. We need someone on our side.
So,
you can't stop smiling, is what you're really trying to say, isn't it?
Forget about where the property market may or may not head. When I look back...
You've never said that before in your life.
No, I probably never will again. But forgetting the future, if we just look to the past, yes. I would say it has been a stonkingly hot market.
Yep.
A really good market.
No one can disagree with that. That right? is absolutely true.
And if these guys can't make money in this market, in the Sydney market, what on earth is happening?
I'm starting to think if we should start paying our listeners for giving you some therapy. This is a weekly therapy session for you, isn't it?
Speaking of dancing with the law here, we can't give personal advice, but for the love of God, if you've got McGrath shares, sell those stinking things and put it into something better. It is an absolute dog's breakfast, and that's all I have to say on the topic.
Well, I've got to say, as we record this on Friday morning, shares at another 7% to 39.5 cents. So the party keeps getting worse. We do need to move on. I will say, for what it's worth, the challenge, though, McGrath, results are terrible. They've bled most of their board and most of their senior management. John McGrath is reasserting control over the business. Now, history will write the story. Whether or not this is the resurgence of McGrath from the clutches of corporate overlords that John McGrath felt uncomfortable with, or whether they were the ones keeping him on the straight and narrow as a listed company, we will see over time. Yeah. How that pans out, no one really can know yet. It's certainly a risky proposition. I think right now you want to see some evidence that there is something turning around in that business, something going on. There'll be plenty of times to buy in if the results start coming through and the business is resurgent. You'll have plenty of chance to buy back in. Holding it and hoping is probably not a great strategy right now.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Man, it's a lovely segue into our next point of conversation.
Let's do it.
Which is knowing when to sell. And this comes from a listener question.
On a warm summer's evening. On a train bound from nowhere.
Please don't.
I'm singing on podcasts.
Please don't.
Really? What am I doing?
So read out. Do you have the question handy? Because I have completely lost it on my screen.
If I can't find it, I'm going to keep singing, you know that, don't you?
Oh, my God. Okay, so the question doesn't really matter.
The window.
The point is, oh, my God, please stop. Please stop.
He began to speak.
Is when do you say? Now, we've talked about it before, and it's something that I think we'll do again because it's a really important thing. When it comes to investing on the market, we're all very obsessed with when do I buy, when do I buy, when do I sell is just as important.
Yep.
And I think we're both on the record as sort of being very much invest for the long term. So mm-hmm. we are slow to buy and slower to sell is a favorite axiom of ours.
Good, isn't it? You stole it from me, actually.
I totally do. Yeah, you know, imitation is the best form of flattery, my friend.
Straight out theft. You might get caught and say it in front of the bloke
you stole
it from.
I'm sure you stole it somewhere as well.
You know, I don't think I did. I don't consciously remember doing it. Yeah, I think I made it up myself, but it's inevitable someone said it before
I'm
me.
I'm Googling
so.
It.
Right.
Anyway, so I'll let you have it until I do that. So McGrath's a good case in point. Yep. Here, because I think what human nature and a lot of the cognitive research shows us is that we hate to take a loss. We might have bought McGrath on the float, you know, around about $1.90 or whatever it was. It drops down to $1.50. You think, oh, what a stinker. Well, at least I'm not going to get out yet. I'm going to wait. I don't want my shares anymore, but I'm going to wait till it gets back.
Right.
So we've talked about the perils of anchoring and all of that kind of stuff as well. So without rehashing all of that, I guess the question is... You give me your approach and I'll give you mine, but what's the kind of thought process that you go through when deciding to sell?
So as you say, I as a general approach, I try and be slow to buy and slower to sell. That generally infers that if I've done the work right when I'm buying and I get that bit right, I minimize the risk of getting the sell decision wrong. Yeah. And so to some degree, if I bought a quality business with good future at a decent price, chances are you want to let that run because it's probably going to look after you rather than hurting you as an average.
You can do that and absolutely be right and still suffer a really brutal loss in the short term. And when I say short, like in the next 3 years, here's a business that's going to go gangbusters over the next 10. You buy it, it goes down 30% and stays there because that's, you know, sentiment is a big influence on price in the short term.
Correct.
So you don't want to have the market psych you out when nothing has really changed.
Correct. The next thing is I look at so when do I sell? The answer is when the investment thesis is broken, to use some horrible jargon. Mm-hmm. Basically, when you buy a company, you say, I am buying this company because I believe over the long term, they will be able to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And then as you follow that company, you're looking for evidence that they either have or aren't delivering on that expectation.
Yep.
And we don't obsess about 6 monthly numbers. It's not about whether it's 10.1% or 9.5% or 11.2%.
Well, you say that, but for most of the industry, that's exactly
right. And that's
about
the important difference, right? Yeah. So our job is to look through it and say, are they growing it at approximately achievable rate? Will it continue? Do the components of that growth, most importantly, I'm actually not looking for the numbers themselves. The numbers are the result, they're the output, right? So it's, are the conditions, are the actions, are the strategies of the business likely to continue to deliver market-beating growth? And that's what I'm absolutely outright looking for. So can Woolworths sell more groceries to more people at a high enough price to justify the growth that I expect them to be able to deliver?
Right.
Will BHP be able to dig up enough stuff out of the ground at the right price over a long enough period of time to deliver compound growth? Those kind of questions. Now, there's component parts of all that, and the results are the results. That's what they're actually doing, and that's a good lead.
Yep.
But you want to look at the specifics of the strategy and the execution, not just the headline result, because often that can fluctuate around a lot. It's the long-term execution and the strategy itself that determines whether or not they're on track as to what you expected them to be able to do.
And it's important, before you can even make a decision to sell, it's important to define, to your words, that investment thesis in advance. So IAG, we talked about before. Now, if you said, I'm going to buy IAG because I think this first half profit is going to be up 24%, good on you, all right? If you've said, I'm buying
IAG... By good on you, he means, don't be so stupid.
You're an idiot.
Yep.
If however, you're saying...
We're offending a lot of people.
Really am offending a lot of people.
Page, P-A-G-E.
If, however, you've said, I'm buying because I think this is, you know, it's the dominant general insurer in the country. They've got a long tailwind. I know it's an insurer, so it's going to have the occasional bad year. And then the next subsequent reporting period, you see earnings drop 10%. Mm-hmm. The market freaks out a little bit, shares drop. Now, has that investment thesis broken, to use your words? I would say no.
Correct, exactly.
I would say, in fact, that's exactly what was expected. You didn't know when and by how much.
Yep.
But if that was always part of it and the broader business is still in place and its opportunities are in place, that is not a reason to sell.
Right. And so Suncorp, for example, we didn't talk about that, but it also reported this week, it had the reverse experience of IAG.
Right.
Profit fell largely because there was a Victorian hailstorm, which cost it $1 squillion to settle. And so it had a fall in profit this year on the back of a good number last year, again, because there was that natural disaster. Both good insurers, I quite like IAG more than Suncorp, but in any case, both decent insurers just had very, very different experience based on just purely nature.
And let's look at an alternate there. Let's say instead of a bad knock from Mother Nature, it was that they had substantially lost market share, that the CFO had been squirreling money in the Cayman Islands illegally. You know,
P-A-G-E.
That is a very different story. That was never part of your investment thesis. That is, you know, you were wrong. No, don't beat yourself up. You're always going to, more often than not, you're going to be wrong because, you know what, none of us can predict the future.
Right.
But when your expectations are demonstrably proven flawed, you have to say, you have to take your medicine and walk away at that point.
That's right. Now, QBE is a great example of that to throw another insurer into the mix just to kind of keep on topic, because that was one where it was supposed to grow. It bought a lot of businesses. It was doing okay for a little while, and the complexity of it kind of overwhelmed it. Mm-hmm. And so you look at QBE and say, do I have – this insurer is very much a confidence game, right? So do I have confidence that the current management team at QBE are reserving for losses appropriately? Do they have a growth strategy? Is the business operationally fit? Mm-hmm. And in all three cases, it was a recommendation of ours years ago, and looked at it at the time and went, no, this is not a case that I feel confident the business is on track over the longer term, and so we sold it. And so that's a good example, a very specific example, and a good one given the conversation today, of where we did sell because we simply didn't have enough confidence that the thesis was playing out the way we had expected it to.
I've mentioned it before, and I will many times again, it's the importance of having an investment diary. It's just that, you know, I speak to so many people. They say, oh, I bought blah, blah, blah. And you go, oh, great. Why? Oh, because the price was trending up and I read something about it. You know, it's not well enough defined. And that's not to be critical. It's really to encourage people to say very clearly and specifically, tell me why you think this is a good investment. And so one part of it is what you expect of the business. And we've talked a bit about that. The second part for me is the valuation part. So there is absolutely entirely possible to do really, really badly as an investor by buying shares in a company that performs very, very strongly. And that is because everything has a price, no matter how good it is. The corner store up the road from your house might be generating incredible returns on investment. Mm-hmm. It might in fact be growing its earnings by, I don't know if there's ever a corner shop in the world that has done this, but growing its earnings at 20% per year, running on the smell of an oily rag.
And a baggy little drops doesn't come cheap these days.
Spewing free cash flow all over the place.
Yep.
But if it's making $200,000 a year in net profit, it isn't a $70 billion business.
Right.
If you pay $70 billion, it will take you centuries to recoup it, and it's just such a terrible event. So at some point between $70 billion and a dollar, there's a very, very sensible price to pay. So yes, you have to have a view on the business, and then you have to work out, well, what is a fair price to pay for them? And that is a whole topic in and of itself.
Yes, indeed. And also, too, I will say that the price you pay and the thesis you have are both moving feasts.
Yes.
So if a business comes out yesterday with earnings that is less than you expected because of whatever reason, the thesis on one level is broken in that, okay, I expected this to be a growing business, grow a reasonable rate over time. It came out yesterday with a 25% fall in profit. Okay, well, I didn't expect that. If it's a one-off, then maybe that's explainable. If it's some simply a matter of it's not as good a business as I thought, that kind of is, to some degree, the thesis broken. The question then, though, becomes, well, what price would I pay for this newly lower quality business, simply lower growth business? Mm-hmm. And there is a price for that as well. So, you know, they're always a moving feast. There is this two-way dance between the quality assessment and the price you're being offered or prepared to pay. And at different times, as you say, quality business, but way too high a price. Reasonably ordinary business, but a very, very attractive price, or anywhere in between for both of those metrics. And that really, that's the art, if you like, of the science of investing, which is trying to work out where it is on those two continuums. And when they're close enough to offer you an attractive idea, then go for it.
Yep.
There is too much you can pay for a great business. There's frankly, you can pay too much for a terrible business, obviously, as well. There are attractive prices and attractive
theses. You can actually do well for a terrible business.
You can do very well for a terrible business. Yeah. Correct.
Mate, we are massively geeking out here.
Aren't we?
And we haven't. And I can hear certain members of the audience going, that sounds great, but man, that sounds like a whole bunch of work. Frankly, I don't have the interest. I don't have the time. So we did promise, we got a bit of feedback throughout the week that, if there was more to pick into, we might do a bit of a PS.
Indeed.
Shall we do a small PS on this after this show? So for those...
You have absolutely taken that and you're going to run with it every week now, aren't you?
I've got so much to say.
Let's give it a shot.
Let's give it a shot at a PS.
Tell us what you think.
Not as a regular feature. And we'll come back to this one because we have hit the 30-minute mark.
Hit us up at The Motley Fool AU, by the way, and tell us what you think about our PS after we've recorded it, which we haven't done yet.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. I really wanted to leave time, mate, because I know it's near and dear to your heart.
Isn't it, though?
Is the good old high horse.
One of my favorites.
Unfortunately, we do not have sound effects this week, which always I die a little bit inside when there's not sound effects.
Listeners, this is theatre of the mind. Imagine, if you will, a stallion, a racehorse, at the starting gate at Flemington. And imagine the jockey, the suave and...
Did I mention we're running low on time?
Okay.
Go for it. What are you ranting about this week?
All right. Here's what I really, really find frustrating is those people who are massive about what they say they knew in the past. Hindsight bias. But I'm not going to rant about the people necessarily. I'm going to rant about the bias itself. And I'm going to try and help. I'm going to try and be helpful with my rant today, Andrew. Okay. I'm going to try and help people overcome that bias, right?
I'm going to help you by ranting at you. I love it.
So here's the thing. As humans, right, we remember the stuff that actually happens. So remember the predictions of those far more than the ones that don't happen.
Yeah.
There have been no shortage of people in the paper over the last year, let alone 3 and 5 years, predicting doom and gloom in China, or for housing, or for the stock market, or for the economy, or
no
for... Choose your option, right? Mm-hmm. It is going to be terrible because... It gets the headlines, it gets the second pages, the third page, it gets rehashed and reheated.
Yep.
Everyone jumps on the bandwagon. And when it doesn't happen, no one calls those people to account because we as individuals don't think about that.
Mm.
Then when the one lucky guy or girl who gets it right, 1 out of 1,000, who finally is lucky enough to get it right, we hail them as superheroes that somehow they had this amazing foresight, this amazing vision. This was always going to happen. It was obvious in advance.
Yeah.
It simply isn't the case. And so if you are someone who likes that, who reads the headlines, who reads the articles, doom and gloom sells. Hindsight bias is a wonderful thing if you're the person who wants to say, here, look what I said. We can come. I've written an article about this. I've written articles, the economy will go well. Mm. The economy will go nowhere. The economy will do badly.
Mm.
That way, in 3 years' time, I'm going to refer back to that article, pick one of those three quotes and say, see, in that article, I said the economy will do well.
Genius.
Or the economy will do badly.
Scott Nostradamus Phillips.
How hard is it, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's then it lends itself to investing as well, because when we look back, when something goes well, we say, oh, I knew that was going to go well. That's why I picked that stock. Or we don't sell. It goes bad. And say, oh, I was worried it might go badly. I knew that'd be a problem.
Mm.
I should have sold.
Yeah.
The whole idea that somehow those things that eventually happen have a higher recollection of our memories is just human nature. It is evolutionary bias, right? That leads us to making really bad, not decisions because they're already done. Mm. What it does, though, is it influences what we do in the future. Somehow that we're either geniuses or we're not. We knew what was going to happen or we didn't. So-and-so is right or so-and-so is wrong. Next time they speak, you like this phrase of mine, Andrew, generals always fight the last war.
Love it.
And so you look back and say, I was right when I said the economy would crash. Therefore, next time I think it's going to crash, I'm going to sell everything.
Yeah.
We don't say, well, I thought it for 5 years beforehand. The share market doubled in that period of time, then fell back 20%. I would have been right to simply ignore it, which I did.
Yeah.
But now I've convinced myself next time I see the same things, I'm going to sell because I was eventually right. One of our former colleagues who's now in a different part of our business, Joe Mager, would say, do you want to be right or do you want to make money? And I think that's the thing. If you try and focus too much on being clever, on somehow justifying or explaining away both success and failure, you run the very, very real risk of succumbing to hindsight bias, and that will cost you money absolutely outright, dead set. There is nothing more certain. If you allow hindsight bias to infect your investment decisions, you will be poorer off as a result.
My response is always, when someone says, I knew that was going to happen, you think, well, did you? Because if I knew something was going to happen with 100% certainty, the financial markets being what they are, I can take a position on that view and I can make a ridiculous amount of money.
Oh,
so
tell me about it.
If it was as obvious as the nose on your face that company X, Y, and Z was going to drop 30%, I would have shorted the buggery out of
that. You know what's worse, though? That's bad enough. When someone says, I knew it, but I didn't act on it, so I should have done it, so next time I'll definitely do it, that's even worse, because that's the one where you convince yourself that...
Selectively.
You know what it is? I thought about it once. I considered it might be possible. I dismissed it out of my mind because of other things. And that one thought is the one that sticks, not the other 15 reasons why I didn't decide on it.
Yeah.
But that one thing when you thought once, you know what, the market could go higher next year or the market could go lower next year. You don't have to hold it with conviction, but in hindsight, it feels like a really clarion call, clear view of the world that somehow at that point you had this beautiful, brilliant, clear insight as to what was going to happen. If only I'd listened.
Yeah.
You ignore the fact that the other 15 times you thought it with different levels of certainty or you were positive for half the time or vice versa, right?
Yeah.
You thought things were going to be great. You didn't buy because you weren't sure. Then they'll go great. So, I knew that was going to happen. Next time I think the market's going to go great, I'll keep buying.
Yeah.
And it's just this, it's human nature. I'm not going to blame anyone for doing it because it's
by the way,
in all of us.
I do it all the time.
Right. Exactly.
So we all do. It's just, it's worth pointing out.
You say to yourself, I wore this shirt last week. It's good to wear again this week. And that was pure hindsight bias.
Sticking by my fashion decisions.
We won't be taking a photo.
No, please don't. mate, I think we'll wrap it up.
I feel better now.
Good.
Do you feel better?
Well, I think this part of this podcast is trying to help the world invest better. The other part is just pure therapy.
Not necessarily in that
it's
order.
It's a win-win scenario.
By the way, I got a tweet during the week from our third listener.
Okay.
We obviously grew the listener base by 50%.
Wow, 2 to 3.
Both of our mothers, plus... So the guy thinks he was
Arnie
the third...
Arnie Gladys is listening as well.
No, someone we don't know, at least unless they're pretending to be someone else on Twitter.
Okay.
The good news would be, if that was true, we'd have increased our listener count by 50%.
I knew that was going to happen.
The problem is... the problem is our mothers don't listen, so this guy's actually now our only listener.
Okay.
That's the downside. So thanks for listening. We appreciate it.
Take that as you will.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for after the show because we are going to pick into evaluation and all things nerdy. We're going to geek out massively on that. But for those that do have to say goodbye, we thank you for your time. Remember, you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app.
And you should.
If you like what we're doing, give us a big fat 5-star rating. It
one, two, three,
us,
four,
and
five.
It is all about us after all. I'm sure.
It's part of our therapist said 5 stars makes us feel happy.
It's
so
all about, yes.
If you're not doing it for you, if you won't do it for someone, do it for us.
For our personal mental health.
Yes. Out of pure pity if you need to.
That's right.
5 stars, please.
If you want a bit of extra foolish goodness, you can go to fool.com.au/Triple M. Until next week, I'm Andrew Page.
And I'm Scott Phillips.
Fool on.
Fool on.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/Triple M.
Okay, so this is a first.
Well, it would be... If a fool talks in the forest and no one hears it, does it really happen?
That's a very good point.
The fact that nobody's actually listening right now, I wonder if we should play music or sing or do something just to see if anyone's actually listening.
Talk about what we're going to do on the weekend or something. Well,
just one time at Bandcamp.
Let's assume that someone's listening.
All right.
And so in this latest podcast, someone asked the question, when do you sell?
Yes.
And it's a very big question. It's a very good question. It's a very big question. We talked a little bit about sort of making sure that you had a clear investment thesis, knowing to walk away when that thesis had been
broken. Oh, you want me to sing The Gambler, don't you?
That's No, I don't. And the other part of it was, please shut up. The other part of it was, is also to have a notion of what is fair in terms of, I mean, what is BHP really worth? What's a sensible, fair price to pay? Is it $5 a share? Is it $100 a share? Is it somewhere between that? And it, all of this makes, I think, sense when you think about it. The trouble is that for my supposition is that for a lot of people listening, they go, well, that all makes sense, but how? How?
Right.
Give me something that I can actually do beyond just nodding and, you know, agreeing with the general platitude. What practical steps can I take to actually do this?
Yes.
Now, this could easily go for 4 hours.
I was going to say, this has to be shorter than the last. That's so our rule here.
Two podcasts. Right. I'm going to try and limit this to 10 minutes if we can. So I'm going to start backwards this time. How do you work out value? Let's talk. We talked about Telstra during the podcast. We said this is a company that's not growing very much. Let's, for the sake of argument, assume it might grow at 2%. It's per share earnings at 2% over the next 10 years. How do you work out what's a fair price?
So here, I'm gonna take half your question and answer a different question slightly and come back to your question. So exactly, only because I do have different approaches depending on the type of company.
Yep.
So when you say how do you do Telstra, that I can answer that question. Mm-hmm. I do want to be a little bit clear up front though that this is not the only way to evaluate or the only type of company we look at. So if it's a particular type of company, then that's exactly what we do, and we'll answer the Telstra question.
And look, 10 other people could be doing this podcast and they come at it a different way. So this is our personal
view.
It's not the right
route. But it's also different if I'm looking at Telstra versus some other company that I might look at. So there are different ways of looking at that information and different details as to how we might go about doing that. When it comes to the specifics of this particular, in Telstra's case in particular, any company is only worth the value of its future cash flows. Mm-hmm. So all the money it's going to earn from now until eternity, discount it back at a reasonable rate that gives you a return on your cash.
Why discount it back?
Because a dollar today is worth more than a dollar in 10 years or a dollar in 100 years or a dollar in 1,000 years' time. Because if you could bought a loaf of bread for $2.50 in 1952, you would have spent your entire week's wage on it. These days, the equivalent loaf of bread is worth a very, very small fraction of a wage. And so price inflation over time, and frankly, the fact that if you give me a choice between a block of chocolate today or a block of chocolate in a year's time, I'll take it today if there's no benefit.
Yeah.
Why wait for the hell of it? I'll only wait if I'm getting a little bit more for it.
Today or two blocks of chocolate in a year.
Exactly.
It's probably worth waiting.
And that's where it comes down to discounting it back. So being paid something to wait for those returns
you're
otherwise
enjoying. So I'm going to reiterate what you've just said then. So the first thing is you're coming up with, and this is a guess, because you can't predict the future, and businesses are very, and economies are very complicated, but you're going to try and come up with what you might consider a reasonable conservative view of what a company may earn in the future.
Right.
So that's step one. Step two is then discounting it back, to your point. How significantly do I discount it back? Do I do rate of inflation? Do I do 10%? Do I do 20%? What do I do?
Yeah, I think it's a hard one to answer. There's no specific answer, right? So there's official a formal intellectual way to do it, which is you take the risk-free rate, in other words, the rate you could get earning some money on something that was completely safe, like a
10-year
government bond. Mm-hmm. And you add to that an extra premium for the risk you're taking. So I want to be paid something for taking the extra risk, so I get the risk-free rate plus something that pays for my risk.
Okay.
The other way to do it is simply say, what return do I want? What do I think the market will return over time?
Right.
And if I'm not going to beat the market, I might as well buy the market, buy a cheap index fund. Mm. So if I want to beat the market, I have to add the market rate plus something to make it worth my while trying to pick stocks.
Okay.
So you can choose a combination of both of those. I normally end up about 10 or 11% as an expectation. I want to get that sort of return from my investments. If I don't, I'll just buy the index and be done with it.
Yeah, right. Okay, I'm with you there 100%. So how far out do you go? Here's the thing. An equity, a share, is an in perpetuity type investment.
In theory, correct.
In other words, like bonds expire.
Mm-hmm.
Term deposits expire.
Yep.
A share, in theory, goes on forever.
Yep.
So someone sitting at home might be going, well, that's great, Scott. So you're telling me I have to forecast earnings out for the next million years? I mean, how do I know what BHP is earning in the year 2072, let alone the year 2172? Is it even around at that point? How do you wrap your head around that intellectual thorn?
I think that's this is the problem with trying to give any sort of specific detailed answers, right?
Especially verbally, right?
Right. Well, but there's no specific way to do it. There's no one way depending on any circumstance. So I guess I don't know how to start answering the question. I think it's very much a case of where's the opportunity, how much are you prepared to pay for that opportunity, yes. and what are the considerations, the risks, the opportunities, and the variability of that potential return as well. Nothing is certain, so you have to allow yourself a decent margin of error.
I'd say this. I'd say for those that are serious on this, and look, you know, this if this sounds like a bunch of work, you're right, it is. It is a bunch of work. Money's just not lying around to be picked up. But, you have to work and you have to think hard for it.
And by the way, the market's already got it for you, right? So you actually, by definition, you have to also disagree with the market and believe the market is wrong before you buy or sell.
I find it a really rewarding, intellectually challenging sort of experience. So it's not for everyone, but if it is, I'd really encourage you to look into it. And look, there's this wonderful oracle called Google.
Ask Google. Much should I pay for Woolworths?
Do some research on discounted cash flow. It's a wonderful theory to sort of get in. Not because the trouble with all of this is you get into this false precision.
Yeah.
Where you start playing around in a spreadsheet, you'll come up with a bunch of numbers, and BHP will be worth $22.73.4789. but it is so ridiculously precise on something that cannot ever be precise.
You know what's funny too is researchers have proven that the more information you have, the more certain you are of the result, and the less likely you are to actually be right.
So where I see the value in that is it's a tool to use to help you think through what needs to happen, to put some numbers around it. And what I'm going to do, because we can't go into discounted cash flow in these 10 minutes that we've got, which we're probably already out of, I want to leave listeners with a very easy rule of thumb as a starting point. Mm-hmm. And this typically works better for more mature companies. Mm-hmm. But there's this thing called the Gordon growth model. And I think it's a really nice rule of thumb. And there's multiple ways of expressing it. But the most simplest is this, is to say that your total average annual return for an investment roughly is going to equal today's dividend yield plus the rate of per share growth. So I'm going to come back to Telstra. Telstra, we know, is yielding, we'll ignore franking credits, mm-hmm. so is yielding about, 7%?
Give or take, yeah.
About 7%. If I want a 10% mm-hmm. return total, mm-hmm. well, I'm going to need this company to grow by about 3% per annum.
Right.
So working backwards, I can come to this idea of, is Telstra a good value at a 7% yield? Well, it is if I feel as though the business can grow at about 3% or more. And that helps frame it all for you wonderfully. Now, let's go back. I'll tie this up because I know people are waiting to use the studio. We're getting some very
and
awful
yet,
glares.
You keep talking.
My studio! is that if...
Here come the police.
Let's say that a company is yielding 3%.
Yep.
And let's say that you think, well, that's a pretty mature company. They're going to get about GDP growth. Maybe they'll do a bit better. I would put Woolies in this camp, frankly. I think they're going to do well if they get more than 2 or 3%, frankly. Right. I don't think they'll get more than that. So if I can add the current yield to that growth expectation and I come up with a number of 7%, mm-hmm. does that mean I should buy it? Well, if you're happy with 7%, that's a really good way to start. If you want more, and mm-hmm. you've made the point that the market average is usually around 10%,
correct.
It might help you determine that that's a little bit overpriced. So that's all a very long way of saying very easily as a nice starting point, take the yield, add the average growth rate to it, and that'll help you work out roughly if something is fair value.
I'm going to put one quick caveat on that. That works very, very well for low growth businesses. It starts to break down very quickly once the growth rate gets up.
It does, and especially because you can have periods of very high growth that then settle down as well, so you get into all of those wrinkles. But as the rule of thumb, I think it's a really good place to start.
Nice.
Well, let us know what you thought of that PS.
If you're still listening.
If you're still listening, because if you ever do want a bit of extra detail, we're happy to do this.
They're about to bash through the door with a battering ram.
We better go, mate.
We better go.
Until next week.
Full on.
Full on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.